So, we've been going a little bit out of order historically, for no reason than my whim. Today we're going to tackle a very interesting relationship of Samson and Delilah, Shimshon and Delilah. Now, we're going to have to start with all of Shimshon's life a little bit, because we can't really understand that relationship to understand who he was. Now remember, historically, this is the period of the judges, this is the Shoftim. And this is the period pretty soon after the Jews first enter Israel. And they conquer with Joshua, and then as we talked about, there's this very complicated period for a few hundred years before there's a monarchy. And there's a constantly a new stream of leaders, there was no succession, there was no order to it, basically. There'd be a leader who was also a prophet, the leader would die, it would be chaos, and often the Jews would find themselves subjugated to another people, usually the Plishtim, and then they would dive into Hashem for a new leader, and Hashem would give them a new leader, and that would work until they died, and the same thing would repeat. So it was a mess. And not that the monarchy wasn't the mess also, that became quite a mess too. Anyone who overly fantasizes about how great things used to be just has to go through Tanakh and say it was never simple. So it was never simple. And Shimshon is born at a time that the Jews are now subjugated again by the Plishtim, by the Philistines. And just the whole story of his conception and birth is already a sign that this is not a normal way of doing things, that God was handpicking leaders. However, this is one of the few instances of where you find the leader handpicked from birth. I mean, what other instances do we see in Tanakh of from birth someone is handpicked to be a leader? Where else do we see that? What are the examples?
Yaakov, kind of. David.
What? Well, David, not from birth, from a childhood, but not from birth.
No.
No, I don't see him. He's not introduced to us until he's already, you know, Moses. A young man. Right. So Moshe is probably one.
Samuel.
I'm sorry.
Shmuel,
right, and Shmuel is probably the other one, I would say, right? I think Moshe is probably one, you'd say, and Shmuel, because when Chana gives birth to him, it's like she already makes a deal with Hashem. Not so that he'll even be a leader, but that he'll be, you know, she's dedicating him for the temple, he'll grow up in the temple, in the basement, and then he will become a holy man. A leader they don't necessarily know. Moshe, they know he'll be a leader. But here we have this rare instance where an angel visits his parents, who are an interesting couple in of themselves. There's this very funny dynamic between Shimshon's parents, Manoach, and his wife. They end up being told that they will have a son, but they have to make sure that the son is a Nazir, is, you know, this elevated status, but the separated status. He can't cut his hair, he can't drink wine, he's going to be something different. Now, again, this is somewhat reflective of this time of the Shoftim. Leaders are handpicked, they're case by case, and they're prophets. So here we have almost an extreme example of that. We have a prophet. Do you want a piece of paper or something? That's okay. Not good. I'll get you paper. Hold on.
Interested
in Jewish history.
Very interesting.
No, there's a fly around, yeah.
Thank you.
I have a rule of thumb. If somebody wants to take notes on what I'm saying, I help them. Okay, so so this angel appears, tells his parents they're going to have this special child. In that sense, it's very unique. It's very unique in that regard, because Yocheved is not told Moshe will be special when he's born. The Midrashim tell us he was born this light, but the Torah itself never says he was born special. That's the Midrashim come out and say that. Here the actual text is telling us that this special child is going to be born and you have to treat him as such. So you'd think if you've got this special holy child, you'd have a picture in your mind of what this son would be like. He'd be the scholar, he'd be he'd be diplomatic, right? You'd have this picture, kind of like what Shmuel became. Shmuel was very diplomatic, he was a leader, but he was, you know, he was open. Instead, you get this hulk of a man who is aggressive, who seems unpredictable, who doesn't seem to fit the archetype of the holy man, right? He doesn't seem to be the holy man. He seems to be anything but the holy man. So he's a kind of a bizarre fit for what he seems to be meant to be. Now, right from the beginning, we see how strange this is. So in the beginning of chapter 14, Yadalid, this is how we're introduced to him. Vayered Shimshon Timnata Vayarisha B'Timnata Mibnot Plishtim. Samson went down to Timnah, and in Timnah he saw a woman of the daughters of the Plishtim. He went up and told his father and his mother, and said, "I have seen a woman in Timnah, the daughter of the Philistines. Now take her for me as a wife." His father and mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brothers and all my people that you go to take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson said to his father, "Take her for me, for she's fitting in my eyes." So right away we see this bizarre behavior. Here you have this man who's the holy man, who's born as told from the beginning he's going to be special. And the first thing we're introduced is that he's telling his parents he wants to marry a non-Jewish woman who's a member of the Plishtim, the group that's ruling them. So again, this picture is even stranger for us. But right from the beginning, the text gives us a little hint as to what's going on. And this is what's so unique about this story. So, right from the beginning, the text is telling us that Shimshon's uniqueness was that he was a prophet, and Hashem was telling him information. Basically, he was a sort of spy, right? Almost like a double agent. And his life was going to be led in a way that he would have to pretend to be one thing and actually be the other. Okay. So, if that's the case, then why was he born this holy man? How would you understand that? Why is the man who is going to spend his life pretending to be a spy, or being a spy, pretending to be someone else, why is he the one born a holy man? What do you think?
He had to be more ethical because a spy can work both the pro and the con.
Okay, so one way looking at it is that he had to have extra safeguards because he was going to get involved in some very dirty business. He was going to be marrying Philistines and doing all sorts of things. Okay, that's one perspective. What's another? Any other ideas?
Strength. Maybe where he was going, he'd need not just physical strength, but the spiritual strength to continue. Because
right.
Sometimes, you know, you're away from your people and from what you usually, you know, you're accustomed to, and it's easy to get let down.
Right. So he needed these reminders. The fact that he couldn't cut his hair, the fact that he couldn't drink wine, was a constant reminder of where he's coming from. Okay, yeah?
It also separates him from the Philistines whom he's supposed to be chummy with.
Right, it's like wearing Hasidic garb when you're, out in the street. This way it's reminding you that you're different. Okay. And it's also a good cover, right? Meaning, it's a good cover to be the holy man who has to get a little dirty. It allows a little more leeway, right? Because when you are under the guise of being more righteous than everybody else or holier than everybody else, people will cut you a little more slack. They'll also be a little tougher on you, but they'll at least give you the benefit of the doubt a little more. So the fact that we have this person that Hashem declares must be this Nazir already kind of gives him this elevated status that gives him maybe a little more leeway. Maybe not as much leeway as he takes, but certainly a little more leeway. So he marries this Philistine girl, but not because he wants to marry her, but because instead of taking them head on and just forming a militia and fighting a war against them, instead he's going to try to embed himself in their culture and take them down from within. That's the plan. Okay? So they have this whole elaborate plan that he on his way to the Philistines, he sees a lion, he kills this lion with his bare hands, then he later sees that a beehive was built up within the carcass of the lion, and there was honey. So at his like shemar brachas, I guess you call them, he gives this riddle to the Philistines, and the riddle is as follows.
Excuse me,
So this is already no longer. Oh, yeah, no, this is only Tanakh. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. We're doing outside. From the eater came forth food, and from the strong came forth sweetness. They could not tell the solution of the riddle for 3 days. So this is the riddle. From the eater came forth food, meaning from the lion, which usually eats others. The food came from the lion because there's this beehive within it. And from the strong came forth sweetness. The lion is strong, and yet the sweetness of the honey. Now, it's such an obscure riddle. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, who would think this? Who would ever think to guess a beehive that creates honey in the middle of a carcass of a lion? So it really is it's an impossible riddle to solve. So they're trying, they make a bet. Before they do the riddle, they make a bet that they'll give him 30 pairs of clothing and 30 sheets if they get the riddle. If they can't guess the riddle within 7 days. So then after it's getting close to 7 days, they can't figure it out. And so this new wife of his, they convince her to, you know, get information from him. He gives her the information. She tells them, of course, but he knows they're going to, and he wants her to. It's all a pretext to attack. So then, when she tells them the riddle, they get it right, accuses them of lying, and then he kills 30 people and takes their clothes as part of the deal. And then later, he goes back for his wife and says, sorry, she married someone else. And again, he attacks. So, you know, he's trying to justify all sorts of behavior within the pretext that he is among them or one of them, and yet time after time after time he is demonstrating that he's not really one of them, and he's trying to attack them. So this kind of becomes his model. This kind of becomes who he is, and it's difficult because he can't even explain. We see even to his own parents he can't explain it. When he is when he tells them he wants to marry this Philistine girl, he doesn't tell them why he's doing this. So he's very alone in this world. He is, you know, by himself. He can't tell anyone else. He can't explain what he's doing. And he has this very kind of close personal relationship with Hashem, that Hashem is sending him on these missions, you know, like these SEAL Team 6 missions, right? You know, that he can't tell anybody about. So, you know, you can imagine it's hard enough to be in SEAL Team 6 and not be able to divulge any information, but at least with the other people there, you can talk about it. So here, he's literally on his own, and not only is he on his own, he's on his own and everyone thinks he's a traitor. His own people think he's a traitor. The Philistines think he's, you know, a terrible person. Everyone hates him. And his intentions really are pure. And he's really just trying to help defeat the Philistines and get independence back for the Jewish people. So, isn't this an impossible situation? Okay? And it culminates that eventually, after he attacks the Philistines a second time, he has this whole plan where he traps 300 foxes. Now, I don't know how you trap one fox, let alone 300. Foxes are impossible to find, right? They're nocturnal, they're very sneaky. So sometimes he finds 300 foxes. He ties two tails together and puts a torch in it. He lets them run wild in their fields, and then they just burn down all their fields. I don't even know where they, you know, who would even think of that? So after that happens, the Philistines go to the Jews and say, we want to arrest him, like, hand him over. So the Jews are ready to hand him over. So again, the Jews don't want him around because he's trouble. And the last thing they need is the Philistines to be angry at them because they're subjugated. The Philistines are ruling over them. The last thing they need is someone in their midst who's, you know, a lone wolf who's rebelling against them. It's just going to come down harder on them. So they have no choice but to hand him over. And the Philistines, so now he's basically putting himself in a situation where he's a lone wolf, and then what does he do? He's able to resist the arrest and kill a bunch of Philistines and run away. So, again, you know, and then eventually he's able to, because of those attacks, become the leader of the Jewish people. So he becomes a shofet, a judge, for 20 years, but he does it in a very different way than the other judges, who were handpicked by God very openly. There's some sort of open war, but there really was nothing. Here we don't have any of that. Okay, now that's kind of the intro to get to Samson and Delilah. So let's read the story inside, and then let's see what we can make of it. Okay, now the chapter begins as follows. Samson went to Gaza. He saw there a harlot and consorted with her. It was said to the Gazites, Samson has come here, so they went around and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They remained silent all night, thinking by the dawn light we will kill him. Samson slept until midnight, and he arose at midnight and grasped the door of the city gate and the two doorposts and tore them out with the crossbar and placed them on his shoulders. He brought them to the top of the mountain and faces Hebron. Okay, so that's the intro story. It happened after this that he loved a woman from the Sorek Brook. Her name was Delilah. The governors of the Philistines went up to her and said to her, entice him and find out by what means his strength is so great, and by what means we may overpower him, so that we may bind him to afflict him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So he falls in love with this woman, Delilah, and now the Philistines think they can get to her, and they offer all sorts of money, and a ton of money if she can reveal his secret. So Delilah said to Shimshon, please tell me what makes your strength so great, and how you could be bound to afflict you. Okay, so she's not very subtle, right? By the way, if I wanted to kill you, what would I do? Right? You know? just I'm just curious, right? You know, it's like, just curious. How much is your life insurance, and how would I collect it if you happen to die tomorrow? You know, like, certain questions should raise red flags. But Shimshon doesn't seem to have that radar. So Samson told her, if they bind me with 7 wet twines that have never been dried, I would become weak and be like any other man. The governors of the Philistines then brought her 7 wet twines that had 7 wet twines, say that 10 times fast, that had never been dried, and she bound him with them. And there was an ambush party sitting for her in the room. She said to him, Philistines are upon you, Samson. And he snapped the twines as flax straw snaps when it smells fire, and his full strength was not even apparent. So, he tells her this, you know, he makes up this fake secret as to what his strength is. She believes him. She does that to him. Then she's the Philistines are upon you, and he's able to break free. Okay, so she says to him, behold, you have mocked me and told me lies. Now tell me how you can be bound. He said to her, if you bind me up with new ropes, with which work was never done, then I would become weak and be like any other man. So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, Philistines are upon you, Samson, and the ambush part was sitting in the other room. Samson snapped them off his arms like a thread. Then Delilah said to Samson, up to now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you can be bound. He told her, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into weaving rod, she fastened it with the peg of the loom. She said to him, Philistines are upon you, Samson. He woke from his sleep and tore at the peg of the loom and the weaving rod. She said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? This makes 3 times you have mocked me and not told me what makes your strength so great. It happened that after she tormented him with her words every day and pressed him, he became exasperated to death. So he told her that all that was in his heart and said to her, a razor has never gone upon my head, for I am a Nazarite unto Hashem from my mother's womb. If I would be shaven, my strength would leave me. I would become weak and be like any other man. Delilah saw that. He had told her what was in his heart. So she sent and summoned all the governors of the Philistines, saying, come up this time, for he has told me what that was in his heart. So the governors of the Philistines came up and brought up the money in their hands. She lulled him to sleep on her knees, and she called over the man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head, thus beginning to afflict him, and his strength departed from him. She said, Philistines are upon you, Samson. He woke from his sleep and said to himself, I will go out to fight like every other time and arouse myself. But he did not know that Hashem had departed from him. Okay. What are your questions from this point? Just before we... What questions do you have in the story so far?
He was all brawn and no brains. I mean, how could he not understand after three times that she was out to get him.
Okay, right. So it seems pretty obvious what's going on here. Right, like I said, if someone tries to kill you three times, you should see the fourth one coming.
Right.
Right. So why does he not see that coming? Okay. What other questions do you have?
What did he mean by the seven locks of his hair?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It seemed like he had seven.
Dreadlocks?
Yeah, maybe. Because he grew long. So if your hair grows long, as we know today, it maybe becomes like ropes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so maybe.
With more dreadlocks.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Right. Okay. Any race, that's what happens to the hair.
Right.
So maybe I have seven of those.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, makes sense.
Interesting.
It makes
like
sense.
A menorah, that's interesting.
Yeah, like a menorah. There you go.
Yeah, it's strange. You guys know that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at it. That's interesting. Some symbolism in the seven. Okay, what other questions do you have? That seems weird.
Well, I my comment is that it seems to me that he thinks that she wants him to love her. So when he finally breaks down and tells her the truth, he's not expecting that she's going to betray him because finally he's told her the truth.
Right.
But in her heart, she always was going to betray him.
So let's start that. Why doesn't he see this coming? Meaning she keeps doing this to him. She keeps tricking him. Why does he not see this coming?
He's obsessed with her.
Okay, so one possibility is he's obsessed with her, and this is a classic case of an evil woman bewitching a man and then turning him to, you know, ruining him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which happens from time to time in Tanakh, for sure. So that's one possibility here. But why is he so susceptible to this?
Oh, he had a bad marriage. His first wife betrayed him.
Well, his first marriage wasn't even a marriage, really. Like we saw, he never really intended to marry the first wife. That was all just a ruse, because he was acting as a spy. So he only wanted to marry her to kind of get in with the Philistines to then begin to wipe them out. So he never really had a real marriage to this point, right? So that could be part of this. He's more susceptible to this trickery because he's never had anyone in his life that he could ever trust. As we talked about, you know, he's in this impossible situation. He's got this unique power from any unique place with difficult and complicated responsibilities, and he can't tell anyone about this, right? He's the spy who can't tell his wife what he does for a living, you know. What was that movie? Was it True Lies? Was that movie?
Spy Who Came in from the Cold.
Yeah. I remember that. What's that movie? I don't know that one. Spy Who Came from the Cold?
Yeah, I Led Three Lives.
What?
I Led Three Lives.
I Led Three Lives?
His wife didn't know he was a spy.
And True Lies, how does that class?
Excuse me, this isn't the
upstairs.
No, that's upstairs.
Upstairs.
Yeah, in the ballroom. Third floor. There's a movie, True Lies, with Schwarzenegger in the 90s.
Jamie
Lee Curtis, right. And he was a spy, and she can never know what he did. And right. So Samson is kind of that, right? But so you can imagine how badly. It's not like he's got an intelligence community who's in on this with him. He has no one else in the world who's in on this with him. So you can imagine how badly, emotionally, he'd want to tell someone, to connect with someone. But why does he trust her? So this almost comes back to the more fundamental question. Well, who was she? Where did she come from? Right? This is all it says. This is all that the text says. Wrong chapter. It happened after this that he loved a woman from the Sorek brook. Her name was Delilah. And then the governors, the Philistines, go to her. Who was she? Where did she come from? Is she Jewish or is she Philistine?
It doesn't say
what she is. So what would you assume? What makes more sense? Is she Jewish or Philistine?
She's Jewish because he's a Nazirite. He's raised as a Nazirite. And what is the probability that he's going to love a woman from that is not Jewish?
Okay, so one compelling argument is he's already the shofet. He's already the leader.
Yeah.
He didn't really intend to marry the Philistine the first time. It's not like he's really marrying Philistines. Why would he marry a Philistine? The assumption would be he's marrying a Jew. Yeah.
Yeah.
The name Delilah brings to mind Lily, Phantom, uh-huh. mystical,
sure.
First wife of Adam.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
So maybe she's a she devil.
In the vein of little. That's interesting. I never heard that, but that's.
Philistine. She's actually not an evil woman. She's doing her for her nation.
Right.
What he's supposed to be doing for the people.
Right.
Nation.
So one possibility is if she's a Philistine, so then, right, she's basically turnabout is fair play. And she's being sent to do to him what he did to her. This is what's called a honey trap. Have you ever heard that term, a honey trap?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah. And so this is something very common that, they won't talk about, but intelligence communities will sometimes have women that they are trained to seduce certain men who they want to get information from. And there's a famous case in Israel of a honey trap. There was a man who moved to London. He knew about that. There's like a secret nuclear reactor in Dimona, I think it is, right? Mm-hmm. And he fled the country and claimed to have like a lot of top secret information about this nuclear reactor. And the Shin Bet wanted to find him and extradite him. So what they did was they sent a woman to seduce him and become his girlfriend, and then they had this secret meeting in like Cyprus or something, and she like said, let's go on vacation to Cyprus or somewhere, and he gets there and the Shin Bet's waiting for him and they bring him back. So it was like somewhat it was a classified mission. But some word got out. She actually is living in Tampa Bay right now, this woman.
Wow.
Yeah, of all places.
True?
Yeah, she's living in Tampa. Uh-huh.
She's an Israeli Jew.
She's an Israeli Jew, but she's living in Tampa. But she wasn't Israeli. I think she was somebody American. I mean, if she was totally Israeli, he wouldn't have trusted her.
Oh.
Because he might assume that she is being sent. So she had to be, from another nationality to be able to pull it off.
Like a Russian Jew.
Right, whatever it was. Right? She couldn't have been Israeli. It would have been too obvious.
Right.
So... And then she fled the country. So I read this article two years back that she was living in Tampa, and they found and interviewed her. She wouldn't talk about it. She claimed not to know anything about it, but they had pictures of her with him when they were together. Anyways, fascinating story. So that's what this could be. Maybe this is a honey trap, right? It's a honey trap that the Philistines are setting back on Shimshon. Now you think, of all people, Shimshon should be able to see this coming a mile away because this is what he does. It's hard to outspy the spy. Right? So that's maybe a question on that. You get why the Philistines would want to do this. The other thing is, at what point do the Philistines come to her with the plan? So they come to her with the plan after they're together. Meaning, it doesn't say the Philistines had this idea and they sent her to, get him to fall in love with her. They do fall in love, and then they come to her with this plan. Which means there's two possibilities. Either she is a Philistine, which it wouldn't be a big reach for them to come to her with this plan, or she's a Jew who's easily corruptible, or feels that her life is in danger if she doesn't go along with it or something. So you got one of those two possibilities. If she's a Philistine, that makes more sense why she goes along with the plan, but it doesn't make so much sense as to why he's falling in love with her and trusting her. That doesn't make sense. Why would he trust her? And the other flip side is, she's Jewish, why is she doing this to him and to the people? So no matter how you slice it, it's difficult to fully understand who she is and why she's doing what she's doing, right? It probably makes slightly more sense to say that she's Jewish, but then you really have to grapple with why she's doing this. Does she feel like her life's in danger? Does she feel like she has no choice? Does she feel like, there's nothing she could do that Samson is really... impenetrable. The other possibility is the plan she goes along with. How conniving is this plan?
Maybe she didn't know exactly what they were going to do with him, but wasn't she also offered money?
Yeah, she was. She was offered a ton of money. So let's think this through. Okay, she's offered...
She's just doing it for the money.
So she's offered a ton of money. They come to her for a ton of money. Obviously, the Philistines are trying a backdoor way to get Shimshon. They realize they can't attack him head-on. He's too powerful. So their only way is to find a backdoor. So they come to her with this plan. So let's say you're her, and she needs to have a plan. What would you do if you were her? How would you go about, not to ask you to use your criminal minds, but use your criminal minds for a minute. What would you do to trap him?
It was actually a bedtime conversation between the two of them, which is not unknown. You know, more secrets are divulged by men in that situation, I think, than at breakfast.
At their most vulnerable. Yeah. Right. So her plan doesn't seem to be so good, right? Mm-hmm. Her plan is, I'll ask him, what's the secret to your power? Does she expect him to tell her the truth? Right? Probably not. First of all, who's to say there's a secret to the power? I mean, maybe he's just really strong, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Who's to say there's some magical secret? Maybe there is, because he seems to have superhuman strength. But who's to say there's something she could ever do that would compromise that? But number two, what does she do? She believes him without questioning, and then she warns him what's about to happen, and then he is able to overcome it. So, is she really trying to trap him, or is she trying to warn him?
Seems as though she's kind of trying to warn him, like giving him a heads up of what's going to happen.
Right, she's giving him a heads up, and she's trying. So one way of looking at this, she's trying to warn him, mm-hmm. and for some reason, he's not following up on the warning, meaning. You'd think after the initial warning, he should now go on the attack, mm-hmm. right? He has not shown any hesitancy in the past to attack them. So now, but why suddenly now is he so hesitant to attack after it's already been demonstrated that they're trying to ambush him? So, you know, is it that he's just tired of this whole thing? He doesn't want to go to war again? Is it that he, you know, it seems that he's now entered a stage of his life. He's fallen in love with her. He's settled down. He doesn't want to be at war anymore. And so maybe she keeps trying to warn him, because this is probably part of a greater plan. They're trying to usurp him. They're trying to find a way to kill him. So maybe you can look at this as she is Jewish. She is on his team. She's trying to warn him numerous times. And then it just doesn't happen. Now, the problem, what's the problem with that theory?
Okay, I would say that in the final chance, she doesn't. Did she warn him? He fell asleep on her knees.
Right.
And then she calls.
Right. So the problem with that theory is
he's totally vulnerable.
Right. She does seem to realize when he tells her the truth.
Yeah.
Right. The way it's put is, right, as we said earlier. It happened that after she tormented him with her words every day and pressed him, he became exasperated to death. I just love that language of this, right? Exasperated to death. I mean, there's nagging and then there's exasperated to death. But Tixar Nafshel Amud, like, he'd rather die than continue to hear about this.
Yeah.
You know, but he doesn't leave her. I don't know, you know, it's like, so and then finally he tells her. And she, when Delilah saw that he had told her all that was in his heart, so she feels that she can, you know, I think women assume they can do this. They can tell when they're getting the truth. They can tell when they're getting baloney, right? Mm-hmm. And she thinks she can read him, and she can tell that this is finally him opening up to her. Mm-hmm. The problem with this theory is, if she feels that she finally got the story, then she should not go to the Philistines if she's trying to protect him. The fact that she does go to the Philistines seems to imply that she was out to get him the whole time. But if she's out to get him the whole time, why was she warning him time after time after time before every initial attack? So, you know, either she didn't really believe him, or she thought that he could overcome it anyway, or she, you know, she felt like this was going to be a way for him to realize what was really happening.
She was working both sides. Both sides. The Philistines and her husband. She was working them both.
How is she working?
In other words, she was cooperating with her husband at the same time she was cooperating. There's a double kind of, they call it a double spy or whatever. She,
right.
In effect, was working both sides of the equation.
Right, because she never tries to, meaning, she asks him directly. Like, she's not snooping around. Mm-hmm. She's not like looking for secrets. She's asking him directly, right? Which is a pretty, again, if you're a spy, maybe, you know, if it's a honey trap, it's still somewhat sneaky. But he knows that he's given the information. He knows he's compromised himself, mm-hmm. right? At some point. Mm-hmm. And still he does nothing. So either he trusts her implicitly to the point where he's able to divulge the secret and still doesn't feel like he's in danger. Maybe he just stops caring at some point, right?
Well, the rabbi said before he never really had this kind of human relationship. He always had to hold secrets out from everyone. And
right.
this was the first time that he felt that he really could relate to a human being without holding everything back.
Right.
So it wasn't only a matter of trust. It was a matter of just needing to be close to somebody.
Right. So it could be that after living this life that he had led, he was just so desperate for someone he could connect with and trust that he was willing to compromise himself. Or maybe he just gave, maybe he just stopped, like I said, maybe he stopped caring. And the fact that he kept getting attacked and doing nothing seems to imply that he just stopped caring. He didn't want to fight. You know, at some point you just don't want to fight anymore. And maybe he's telling her knowing what's going to happen. Right? Maybe on some level he knows how this is going to play out and he doesn't care anymore. You know, he's like, okay, you know, look, it's not even worth it. You know, so it seems like he's weakened, but he's not weakened physically. You know, his downfall so much is not that he's weakened physically when she cuts his hair, it's that he's emotionally and psychologically weakened before that ever happens, to the point that he's willing to reveal, you know, his secret. Now, what's also complicated is what happens. So the Philistines attack, and they overwhelm him, and they kill him. And they trap him. So they bring him out. Okay, so the governors of the Philistines gathered to make a great sacrifice unto their God for celebration. They said, "Our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hand." The people saw him and praised their God, for they said, "Our God has delivered him into our hand, our enemy, and the destroyer of our land, the one who increased the numbers of our slain." It happened when their heart became merry, and they said, "Summon Samson, let him entertain us." They summoned Samson from the prison, and he came before them. They stood in between the pillars. Samson said to the boy who was hiding, holding his hand, "Let go of me and let me touch the pillars that the building rests upon, so that I may lean on them." Now the building was full of men and women. So he ends up, Samson called out to Hashem and said, "Remember me and my strength just one time." Hashem allows him. He pushes down the pillars. The whole building collapses and kills them. So it's weird because, you know, the idea that his strength was tied into his hair is a bit of a strange concept. I mean, why would God create a situation that his, you know, what if he had gotten his hair cut? What if something had happened? I mean, to say that his strength is tied, physically tied into his hair, when his strength didn't seem to be based on physical reality, almost based on spiritual reality, based on God's giving it to him. And it seems they can come and go. Even after his hair is cut, he asks God, and Hashem brings his strength back. So it almost calls into question, to what extent was the hair ever the cause of the strength?
Yeah. But I think that Delilah, when he told her it was his hair, I think she didn't really believe that, because just think, this person with this superhuman strength said, "Oh, my strength is in my hair."
Right. It's almost difficult. Well, I
wouldn't believe it. Would you?
Right.
I mean, she's hair. It's like, no.
She seems to believe it. Right. She seems to believe it. So, I mean, it's a question of, was the strength in his hair, or was God's protection predicated on him being a Nazir, which we talked about, offered him extra protection, and that was part of the arrangement. The only way, the counterbalance to him having this extra strength was being the Nazir. So it wasn't that he physically got weaker after she cut his hair. It was that the spiritual deal, you might say, that he made with God, God made with him, was lost at that point. But again, and maybe at some point he just thought he didn't care. You know, I guess the new Superman movie just came out, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Have you seen it yet?
Not yet. No. I want to see a trailer.
What? You saw the trailers, right? So, I mean, Shimshon's kind of like the Superman figure, right? That he's got this superhuman strength. But, you know, with that comes a very complicated life, right? What's a big plot in Superman is that he's Clark Kent, right? Mm-hmm. And what's Clark Kent's greatest frustration? Right? He can't tell anyone that he's Superman, right? That's the worst part of being Clark Kent, is that, yeah.
It was written by two Jewish guys, Schuster and Siegel, in right. the 1930s.
Right.
And it's almost a biblical figure, Superman.
Right. Yeah. I wonder.
I heard that it was kind of a base of Moses.
And Moses, you think?
Yeah. I heard it last week in the radio.
How is it based on Moses? What's the Moses
you
connection?
Know, Moses was raised in some other places.
It was
at home.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Superman is very ethical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But I feel there is some Shimshon concepts in Superman. Mm-hmm. The superhuman strength.
Yeah.
But there is, right, for, you know, the kryptonite, which for him is hair, for him is literally kryptonite, right?
Yes.
The idea that there's something out there. The woman who's, I mean, Lois Lane is not trying to trick him into giving
he's
up his secret.
He's also a stranger in a strange land. He's not born on Earth. He comes from
right.
kryptonite.
Right, right. So, right, but the frustration of him not being able to be honest with who he is, there's a frustration that comes with that, you know? And at times, I'm not a big Superman expert or anything, but you know, my sense is, you know, all these superheroes, part of what comes out of it is this frustration with having to be Superman or be Batman. At some point, they just want to be normal. It's like, you know, it's yeah, it sounds fun in the beginning, until you have to constantly do it, and you're constantly dealing with all this stuff, and at some point, you just don't want to deal with it anymore. It's like, okay, someone else's turn. So I think on some level there could be someone that here with Shimshon, that after so many years of doing this and living this way and being alone and living in secret and taking on the world, it could be at some point he just stops having that fight in him and he's almost happy or relieved to give up his secret and to just kind of be done with it. So that's one way of looking at the story, maybe, is that he concedes the pointer at some point. And maybe he knows exactly what's happening, right? Now, if you really want to take it another step, it could be possible that Samson thinks that this is going to be the one last trap. Meaning, he sees this coming a mile away. He realizes that the Philistines are going to try to trap him. He finally tells Delilah what's going to happen, knowing that they're going to get him. And then he's going to be able to attack them one last time. So it could be that this is his like final foray, you know, like this is his one last trap. He goes out with a bang to a certain extent. Maybe he doesn't realize that if they cut his hair, he'll lose all his power. Maybe he realized that and knows he can, you know. So that's part of the question. So that's another way of looking at it, is that maybe this was his plan the whole time and he wanted to bring them down one last time. So it's part of the complication of the story, is because the behavior seems so bizarre and there's so little explanation attributed to why all this is happening, that it creates this just really strange, bizarre relationship and dynamics here.
Was she ever referred to again after the end of the
story? No, I don't think so. I think this is it. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that Delilah remains a Jewish name. I've always found that very interesting. You know, people still use it.
Yeah.
Which I don't know what to make of that.
What does it mean?
Night.
What?
Night. Isn't it Lila?
It could. I mean, the Talmud has a few different explanations as to where the name comes from. I'll tell you them real quickly.
Well, I have a cousin named Lila.
Lila?
Lila.
Lila. Lila.
Yeah. So Dildel Kocho Umasav. So Dildel in Hebrew is like to confuse or like to weaken. So they say it comes from like that she weakened him, his strength, and she weakened his resolve. So it means like to confuse and to weaken. That's how the Talmud interprets her name. But again, that's after the fact. You know, she wasn't born and her parents said, hey, you weaken someone one day, we'll call you Delilah. But, you know, after the fact, that kind of becomes her name. Now, there's also discussion, maybe she was Philistine and she converted to Judaism. So therefore, he trusted her because he thought she was Jewish, but she really never... her heart was never really in it. she was tricking him by converting. That's another way of looking at it. So you, if you want to kind of have a middle ground where it makes sense she would work with the Philistines, it would make sense he would trust her, maybe she converts, but she's not really sincere in the conversion. So that's another, you know. So anyway, a lot of questions.
I never saw this type of analysis. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Thank you. No, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. All right, so we'll stop here. Next week, we're going to tackle Mordechai and Esther. And Mordechai and Esther, it's so complicated. Just what their relationship was is very complicated. And we're going to read this story in two different ways. We're going to read the story as if they're a married couple, and we'll read the story as if they are not a married couple. And we'll see the proof for both ways of looking at it, and then we'll read the story twice and see how the reading of the Megillah changes based on that basic question. That will be our last class for a little while, because I'm taking off. I'll be gone mostly in July and be back in August, but we'll have all the email will go out both.